Welcome, welcome,
Love
welcome.
Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Russell Price Morning Show, pulling your eyelids open. We give it to you straight talk every morning from 10 to 11. We give it to you where the ghost can get it. On our newsmaker line, we have the one and only Catfish Mayfield. Catfish Mayfield is an awesome, awesome individual who has been in this town for over 50 years. He was born here in this town, and he could tell you things about Washington, D.C. that nobody else ever really knows. So he is all that in a bag of chips. Welcome aboard, Catfish Mayfield. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I hope all is well. I am truly honored to be able to say where we've been, how we got there, and where we need to go.
I tell you, Catfish, you know where the ghost can get it, boy. You know where everything is at because you've been to D.C. for real, for real. I mean, what do you contribute? First off, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
That's kind of, it's almost, I can understand how when I interview people, and then when I'm interviewed, you know, you don't like to try to reinvent yourself or try to stick your chest out. My family came up from North Carolina. I'm the only one out of six kids that were born in D.C. And so, at that time, I did not really know that D.C. Was segregated. We lived in the projects out there off of Kenilworth Terrace. My mom was a person that really did not know how to read or write. Because that's the reason why they called that generation the greatest generation and what they were able to achieve. My father could read, but they were some hardworking parents. It was six of us, and I was the youngest of the crew. I did not know that we were poor. I didn't know that we were in a segregated when I was growing up. I went to Neville Thomas Elementary School. But then we also had, and I realized it early on, and I felt the pain. We had a color difference in us at that time. If you were light-skinned and things like that, oh, my God. You thought you might have seen Christ, but if you had this dark skin, you were picked on. And so therefore, how I got my quick wit is they always trying to joan on us, making us seem like. So now, that's the reason why we really didn't realize about whites, you know, segregation. But we had an issue in our own race. The darker you were, oh, my God, you had. We had one of my best friends, his name was Bosco, the nickname was Bosco. So you can almost tell how dog-skinned he was. And that's what we went through. I went to school, Neville Thomas Elementary School out there in Parkside. And I didn't know that there was a difference until I started going through school, I went to Chamberlain. I went to the university, and then that's when I started finding out that there was this profound difference in us as a race of people. So what really turned me around, and no one in my father, in my family ever had a car. So I used to go, and they used to put keys in the car in the daytime, in the used car. Well, I made them stop that. Because I would go and get the key and then go get the car, put a tag on it, and I would ride to school, and everybody would say, Catfish, where do you get this car? Every week I had a new car, and that I put a tag on, we went to school, and it made me like the center of everybody. And eventually, the house that I live in today is that I had the car. My mom asked me, are you doing anything wrong? I just feel different, that you're doing something wrong. I said, no, no. I was going to Chamberlain High School. I went out and get in that car. When I went in that car, police jumped up from everywhere, and the chase was on. And I made it back to the stair of my house, and I was hollering for my mother. And when my mother came, because she said in her dream, she said, that day I saw a white man holding you. I said, she said, are you doing anything wrong? I said, Needless to say, when I made it to my back step and I was hollering for my mother, and she came out, and that white man had me by the shoulder. So that put me on to a trajectory. Every time I always got locked up was unauthorized use of a car. I go put tags on them and ride around people. Who's this car? My uncle and things like that. But what it did for me, I went to Cedar Knoll, the National Training School that was up on Bladensburg Road, and then I went to the youth center because that's when the Youth Act was kicked in. But it gave me the greatest insight of this disparity. Although I was young, you can't even begin to understand what inmates go through in that animalistic environment, in that they have to make sure that you are strong enough to survive or you will become somebody's bee in that incarceration. So therefore, I had to learn the skills of survival, although all I have ever been locked up for was unauthorized abuse. But I was put with those animals in there. And that's the reason why I have been working with the returning citizens that get out to get them, because they must be detoxed. Why must they be detoxed? Because you cannot imagine what it takes to survive in incarceration. And so when I got out on May, but then in May, they had that my friend, I was on Minnesota and Benning Road, and my friend, Clarence Booker, came up. And so then the police came up. And his name is Officer Rule. Never can I forget his name. And so what happened was that someone had stole something out of the A&P on out there off in Northeast. And so the police came up. So the person that the police initially was talking about was this dude we call Fat Nasty. So you can almost tell how Fat Nasty looked, because that was his name. So the police had gone to him to say, because that's who they said stole the cookies. And so Bug, when Fat Nasty threw the cookies on the ground, Clarence Booker picked them up. And he was making fun. Hey, Fat Nasty, you want your keys? Cookies, I'm sorry. And he said, I don't have no time for no cookies. So Clarence Booker, Bug, threw the cookies back on the ground. All of this is in a book.
Wow.
And so,
How did you get your name Catfish?
Okay, I'm going to get to there. If I'm running, because this is my genesis. The reason how I got the name Catfish, I lived in Tarzan. It was the Eastern River Branch. My daddy would be going, he was in the federal government. And he loved fishing. But he only could really go fishing on the weekend because of his job. So what he did, he would go down to the river behind the project. And he would just, he was an avid fisherman. And so he would be walking through Parkside. He always embarrassed us with these catfish. We never ate them. He gave them to other people. And so they used to try to call my daddy the catfish man. But my daddy wouldn't go for it. And he said, boy, I don't play. Don't disrespect me. So then, because I was the youngest of all of my clan, they started calling me catfish. And I couldn't beat them. I couldn't do that. I was angry they used to call me catfish. And so I had almost lost the nickname catfish until when I got out of the youth center, I was standing on Minnesota and Benning Road with the rest of my friends over by the post office. And this police officer came up because there was an incident that happened at the A&P about a 29-cent box of chocolate chip cookies that someone had supposedly stolen out of the A&P. So Officer Rule is his name. Never can I forget that. And so he was talking to Fat Nasty about the cookies. And then when Rule realized, Fat Nasty, you can almost just surmise in your mind how Fat Nasty must have looked like. And so Clarence Booker, which is Bug, when Fat Nasty took the threw the cookies on the ground, Bug picking up, Fat Nasty, you want your cookies? I'm messing with him. I don't have no time for any cookies. So what winded up happening then, when Bug threw the cookies on, Officer Rule felt that was his out. So because Bug was a small built person. So he said, when he threw the cookies down and Bug put them back, he said, you under arrest for throwing the cookies on the ground. He said, officer, but you saw what I just did. So they got into a tussle. If anybody know about Minnesota, Benny, and where all of that runs together, it was a post office, a restaurant. So if we ever got in trouble, we would run across the bridge to Parkside. So Bug snatched away from the police. And I thought the Bug would be in Parkside by now. But when I got behind the post office, him and the officer were fighting. So Bug hit him, the officer hit him, and then Bug hit him with a good shot. The officer's knees buckled, and he pulled his gun out. And they got the tussling over the gun. So Bug called to me. I'm standing up on the bump where the post office right comes in to pick up their mail. And he hollered to me. They got the fighting. And he hollered to me and said, catfish, help me. I said, man, let that gun go. That man ain't going to shoot you for no 29 cent a box of chocolate chip cookies. Let's get out of here. Oh, how wrong was I?
You were definitely wrong. They would shoot you for that.
No, back then, I was wrong because I did not. I'm trying to understand.
No, you were absolutely right. You were wrong because they would shoot you for that box of cookies back then. And now they still do the same thing. The police brutality and shoot is still the same as it was back then as it is now.
I mean, it's no difference because I have been involved with a couple of other ones that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And so what when Bug let the cookies go and turned to run, you know, he that's when Rule shot him in the back. At that time, I did not know he was shot. And so it's a way that you can run beyond Minnesota, by that part, go down under the bridge of Minnesota Avenue, come back up, you'll be on the other side. So I was able to go down there with Bug. Bug was laying on the track. Bug told him, Officer Rule, that he was shot. When he pulled his shirt up, the bullet must have went in so clean. He pulled his shirt up and said, nigga, you are not shot. But if you move, you will be. And so the next morning, my mom said about this person that was killed. Because I called to the up there at the hospital to ask how he was doing. He said he was still in the emergency room. And so my mom said heard that this young boy was killed that was living in Parkside. And I said, no, he wasn't killed. He was shot, but he was no, they said he was killed. So when I found out that Bug was killed, I called Ruth Basehard. She was big time in D.C. government. That's in a book. And I told her about what happened. She said, can you come down to the district building? I said, I don't have any money. Catch a cab. You have to look up who Ruth Basehard was. Big time. And she did a book, and this is in there. And when I was there, she then called, you know, came down, paid for the cab, and then that's when my trajectory started changing, because the next person that I was going to be encountered, the doorbell rang. Guess who was at the doorbell? Marion Barry. And so
that's how you met Marion Barry.
Huh?
That's how you met Marion Barry.
That is how I met Marion Barry. And so what winded up happening is that he said, because of my, although I was never locked up for anything but unauthorized use of a vehicle, jail is, like I said, is an animalistic. They can't protect you in there. And that's the reason why individuals in recidivism takes so much hold, because you just cannot imagine what goes on in there. You just can't go in there and do their time. You have to be the animal to survive. And so I saw the transformation in me when I got out. And so when my friend was killed, Marion came. But jail gave me an insight. I was raised by some good parents, and I had strong people around me. But what was missing out of me is the empathy in what was going on in this country. And so when Bug got shot, I got all of these young individuals, and we were raising hell. I just saw Dr. King and them doing stuff. I started, and the next thing I know, the doorbell rings. Who is it? Marion Barry. So Marion came, and so he said, what can we do to stop this? And because of my past of understanding incarceration, although, like I said, I never did anything but unauthorized, but I understood I had to survive in there. So therefore, he asked us, what could we do? I said, what we must build is a foundation of young black folk, and we must catch them at an early. And that's how Pride came. And Mary Treadwell, it's me, Mary Treadwell, and Marion, and L.D. Pratt. And so they pimped me, and so the federal government from the Labor Department gave us a $300 $100,000 grant to run a program. I called it Pride. We were so successful in the what was his name, Nancy? Works call and said he called me in. Everything was going right, and I had no problem when we just had the $300,000. But then when we started getting the millions, that's the reason. Then that what happened then is that it wasn't more so Marion, but Mary Treadwell that later became one of his wives. And so therefore, they tried to push me in the back. And so for that period of time, Marion was taking Stokely. I mean, I met them all, Dr. King. He was taking a hell of a whooping of how he had tried to push me in the back. Then he was forced to come and get me. And then at that point, he brought me into D.C. government. But he wouldn't let me do anything. I was a grade 13, 14.
And people wanted me to do things. In the 70s.
Yeah. He wouldn't let me do anything. I was in the Department of Human Services initially.
But let me ask you a question.
Eventually.
Catfish.
Hmm?
You were making, you all had a $300 million grant back in the 70s?
No, we got the first, when we first had the 300,000, then when we started getting the million, that's when they pushed me in the back. Now, it wasn't Marion more so, it was Mary Treadwell.
Mary Treadwell, yeah. Mary Treadwell was the one that was a controversial about her because that, when she saw y'all getting millions of dollars, then they didn't want you to be out front anymore. They pushed you in the back.
That's what it is. That's what it was, and that in Marion. And they would start pushing Marion. Because Marion used to just come over here, where I live today. They just would ask me about my walk. Because it was like that, although that the Lord, because I was a churchgoer, I'm only one of the ones that out of the six stayed in the church. I teach Sunday school now. But it was like they knew where my stance, where my lines in my life. If a person doesn't have lines in their life of what they will do and cannot do, that's a terrible person. But so because I had to survive in an animalistic environment, Marion then asked, how can we stop the killing? How can we stop? And so I said, because of my experience of surviving in incarceration, I was a prime target to be able to say, this is what you need to do. And they used to come and keep me. And before we wrote the first piece, the foundation for Pride. And the reason why I called it Pride is because that no one really was respecting young black individuals. And so I said, we're going to call it Pride, Pride Incorporated. We will show and distill how young black individuals, it's not all, running around doing this, doing that. And so when we got the $300,000 from the Labor Department, and everything was all right. So then Willard Wirtz, with the secretary, so he called me in one day and said, Catfish, because he asked me what could he call me. He said, what do you want me to call you? I said, what do you want me to call you? That's how wild I was. Can I call you Willard? He said, yes. I said, you can call me Catfish. And so he said we had no intention in going beyond that $300,000. But the success that you had had, and then he said you had had, we were forced. And then when we started getting the millions, that's when, more importantly, Mary Treadwell started trying to push me in the back.
What kind of thing did you offer the city for those millions of dollars? What did you do? You created jobs. Tell us what you did with the millions when you got millions of dollars. What did you do?
Because of the relationship that I had with all of the young folks, I knew where their schism, I knew where their talent. So I knew if we were able to get those young folks, because you got to remember now, I've had the, you know, the indoctrination of what happens in incarceration in juvenile. And so therefore, I was able to structure, like marrying them, they would get me, they would keep me up for hours in building the platform of what pride should look like. And that's the reason why I called it pride, that we must instill, we must show that our walk is reflective of success. And the next thing I know, now I'm walking with the president, the vice president. I could call Nixon. I was wild. I would call the White House, and I just said I want to speak to the president. And they say, who's calling? I said, Rufus Catfish Mayfield. And the next thing I know, guess who got on the telephone?
Nixon.
And so
you had it like that. So back in the day, the word was on the street that it was that Marion Barry had took pride from you, but it really wasn't Marion Barry. It was Mary Treadwell that sort of pushed you in the back.
But he permitted it because, see, Marion was trying to find a way to get away from pride. Because now he's making a new trajectory into politics. That's how Mary Treadwell winded up with it and going to jail.
Yeah, she went to jail. Because she juggling that money around. See, the problem was the money, like you said, the millions of dollars was not going where it's supposed to go. And she had control over that.
But see, you got to also understand Marion had a part. Because instead of him dealing with it, you know, he winded up. And you got to understand this also. Marion was just being introduced to the Georgetown crew. And his wife, that became his wife, Effie. You got to understand that Effie is the one that introduced Marion to the Georgetown crew that gave him the type of platform to run for the council, run for mayor again. Effie played a big role in remaking of Marion.
So it was Effie Barry that had the connections then. It was Effie Barry who actually had the connections.
Yes, you gotta go. I bet you was. Go back and research her. She had a whole amount of clout, especially in the Georgetown. That was the transformation. That was the beginning transformation of Marion. And then he just gave, like, pride to Mary Treadwell, and eventually she wound up going to jail about Clifton Terrace and all of that. He was pulling himself away from the foundations of an activist to a politician.
How was she able to take control of pride when you founded it? How was she able to get a hold of pride and like she was running it and it belonged to her and she had control of the funds? How did she get to be in that position?
Because Marion was taking one step out of being an activist and beginning to take a step in a politician. That's what you have to remember that. Effie is the one that began to reshape Marion into the politician. He could have never, ever been what he was without Effie Barrett.
Yeah, she was good for
him.
She was definitely good for him in all aspects.
Yeah, but I mean, because she was quintessential up in Georgetown. And so that became the remaking of Marilyn. And when he, like I said, when he left Mary Treadwell. And then at that particular point in time, they were also doing something up at this big project. And then she was stealing money from there because that's when she went to jail.
Right.
But Marion had gone.
Marion had gone, right. Marion had gone. He had gone, and then he ended up marrying Effie Berry.
And I would not be doing myself due diligence. It was a white brother that was with us, L.D. Pratt. This white boy, oh, my God, he could do things. He could make things work. But what happened was, one day, LD came over my house, and I said, "What's wrong, LD?" I said that, you know, I'm no longer with the team. I said, "Why?" And I went off when I found out why. Because LD was white, but he was a major point in Rufus Mayfield's life. Marion Barry, Mary Treadwell, he was a foundation. But because somebody found out that a white boy was working with us and calling some shots, Marion, for the longest, I would never forgive Marion Ford, because they then pushed LD over the cliff. I stayed in true contact. He lived out there in Maryland, and I used to go a lot of times before he died. So politics are really, you know, really, really, really bad. And that the way they pushed Marion over top of me, I went up one day to the on 15th Street to the office. And so somebody asked me to watch a girl, Barbara, said, you know, Catfish, watch the telephone for me, you know, while I have to go do something. I said, okay. This young lady from the NASA, I talked to her to this day. And she said, "I would like to speak to Rufus Catfish Mayfield." And I said, "This is he." She said, "Thank God. We have been trying to get over. She's from NASA." And she wanted me to come out there to do a talk on diversity. And she said, "Every time that we try to ask for you, they said my schedule was so busy that we could send Marion." And I said, "My schedule has not been busy." And so when the secretary came back and said that, I asked her, I said, "What's going on? What are they doing?" And she took me to the file cabinet. They said, "Any communication that is for Catfish, give it to Mary Treadwell. Just stacks of stuff." And so when Marion came in, I said, "You know, Marion, what is this?" And that's how we fell out. "What is this?" And so I winded up in entertainment. No show that came in this town that I did not MC. But then Marion was
How did you get to be in entertainment? How did you make a transition from Fry to being a comedian and to be MC for all those big shows? What was the context for that?
That's a good question. My quick wit. You know, like when I was incarcerated, I told you I loved to steal cars. Never stole anybody's personal car. Always from a used car. So that should make it a little better. So here's what happened. So, see, my daddy, I told you my daddy be walking through the River Branch down there. And so he'd be walking around with those catfish. And when I just, and my people always, like I said, they used to say to him, catfish man. But like I said, that my daddy didn't place. So I got stuck with catfish. Then when we, this is what really took it off. When the Labor Department gave us the first $300,000, I still have that article today. And now who's not going to read this article? A catfish gets $300,000 to run a program. Now who's not going to read that?
Well, that was big time. Back then, catfish, that was big time. That's when D.C. was Chocolate City. And we needed to help each other and support each other. And you took the reign of your, like I say, by you having the pride organization. But then when you got into the entertainment field, I remember seeing you down Mark IV hosting the show.
Yeah, be
Mark
nice
IV,
with that. Because my wife is listening too. Be nice.
I know all about it.
And then you were at the Constitution Hall.
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
Constitution.
You're going too hard, man.
Your name was synonymous with everything, but then you were able to see Marion Barry go from working with you at Pride to becoming the mayor of D.C. And you watched him, but then did he ever reach back and give you any kind of acknowledgement at all?
You know, the good thing about, here's where my life is with Marion. And I am so glad of what I'm getting ready to say, because my soul is free. Marion was dying. This is what I carry deep in my bosom. Marion was dying. And I told everybody in the house, in the room, get out. Get out. No one was in that room but Marion and I. At the Players Club. And I just told, and he's sick now. You know, he's sick. And so I told even his handler. We was over there at the Players Club over near Southeast. I told her to get out. I ain't say get out like that, but please leave. Marion is dying. And he said, catfish, did I ever really thank you? I said, not really, Marion. Not really, Marion. But guess what, Marion? It could not have been a catfish Mayfield without you. And it could not be a you without me. I realized that, Marion. And do you know that that was something that had delivered me from our schism? And that's what I carry in my heart today. That brief conversation before he died. My soul is free because what he said to me and what my answer was, I could not have been what I possibly was or was without Marion. But I also know Marion surely could not be without me. And that's
you
the reason
each other.
Why.
Y'all helped each other. Y'all started something that was so profound. He went on to become the mayor, but he couldn't have been what he was if it wasn't for you. On our newsmaker line, the one and only Catfish Mayfield. The number here is 516-418-5482. If you want to speak to Catfish Mayfield, the number is 516-418-5482. Catfish, you have done so much to this town. What do you think of today, watching D.C. the way it is today, and what you knew it was yesterday, what do you think contributed to how D.C. is today? Was it the other mayors that came along? Was it Fenty?
Here's what happened. And you go back and check the record, you'll see it. When Marion created the black middle class, the highest grade for blacks in government was 4, 5, and 6 and things like that. Marion was able to take those Negroes to a grade 12, 13, 14. And in some cases, because I made it up to a 15, 16, instead of them having insight, instead of them staying in the city, guess what they did? They deserted us and ran to Prince George's County. The white folks didn't steal D.C. The black middle class deserted us. That's what opened up the door for these white folks to come in. And I used to go over some of my friends' house, and they had, you know, I mean, I used to get jealous when I used to go see those houses. And I noticed that how cathedral ceiling, I mean, 3 and 4 floors. But then I noticed something. Every one of those houses that I would go into, it was like a space heater in the top stairs. Why was that so important? To heat and to cool those houses with a mortgage note. And so that the door now was open. Please understand, white folks did not take D.C. Black folks deserted it and went to Prince George's County.
And now they can't get back in D.C. Cannot get back in D.C. The ones who went to Prince George's County couldn't come back to D.C. as they tried.
That's what I'm talking about. Now, look at this. The houses, I live on Bay Street. I ain't going to tell you what address because somebody might come around here and try to beat me up. I live on Bay Street. It's 44 houses on Bay Street. And out of the 44 houses, it is only around about 7 or 12 black. The rest of them are white. The rest of them are white. And it's not like white folks took it. White folks came in. They came in what black folks left open. And so now on our particular street, on Bay Street, it's only 14 or 12 families are black. And I feel out of place because it's like I get a feeling that the white folks that are here only saying it's only a matter of time before you and the rest of the few blacks on the street. But you would be proud of me. You know why you would be proud of me? Because here's my mom, here's my dad, hardworking man. And I forgot to say this. And then I don't even know how my mom got into the White House. Because I used to have to teach her to just write her name and be able to read her name. But my mom winded up in the White House. She was doing tours for the church and all of that. To this day, I don't know how. But I watch how that generation laid out a platform for us. And so I just stood on that platform. And so when my mom died last, and I was the care of the estate, I said, I don't want to live in no grow house like my daddy said. But then I just went out back And I said, I wonder if I can move this house back around about 100 feet or so. And I had an architect come over. My mom died in 2000. And he came over and said, let me work up something. And so he came and worked up something. When you come in my house, it will blow your mind, the depth of it. And now, guess what everybody's doing to the row houses? They're popping them up and pushing them back. Because you got to remember, they're row houses. Now, what did the Bible say? A man without a vision, he's lost. I saw the potentiality of having some of the work that I would want in a house. And so the house that I grew up in, and I did this in 2000. And so again, I teach Sunday school. How do I prepare you for your worst day? How do I prepare you for your walk that people can see me through you? Because, again, you might be the only Bible that a person will work in the course of the day to read. So, therefore, my life, now I work with the opiate patients. I work with the returning citizens. Those are the individuals that are coming out of jail. Why am I doing that? Because I was brought to prominence, not because I was a great scientist, not because I was a great orator. I was put in there because my friend was killed by a police officer. So I never forget how I came to where I am. I owe the Lord something that you should be able to see something in me.
Well, you're still here. That's the main thing. You're still here, Catfish. You're still here. A lot of people that you know back in the day are gone. A lot of politicians.
That's the reason why I feel alone a lot of times. I do.
You're still here, alone. And you have history. That's why it's so important that people know you, know what you did, and what you have contributed to D.C. Because the people who live in D.C. today have no idea what Catfish Mayfield did. What Catfish Mayfield and Marion Barry did. I look at people today in D.C., the new people who have moved here in D.C., when you mention Marion Barry's name, all they can think about is the crack that he did. They don't understand what he really did. They don't understand. They don't understand who Marion Barry really was. The new
really was.
People have moved here. People who have moved here in the last 10 years, when you say Catfish Mayfield or Marion Barry, some of them may not even know who Marion Barry is or who you are, because their city is not giving you. There should be a statue somewhere. Somewhere downtown, they got a statue of Marion Barry. There should be a statue of you, because you were there before Marion Barry was there.
And let me say this. Since you know. Like I said, I'm hoping that I said. Nancy's shaking her head that I have said. She almost knows what I'm getting ready to say. A wife is really good to make sure a person is not redundant. But this is what I hold in me. You know, like I said, one thing that I really, really hold deep in my heart, and that is my talk with Marion right before he died at Players Lounge. And his
was so special to you, because you had all those years where you wasn't speaking or you had some kind of rift between you and him. But then when you were able to go to the Players Lounge, and that's the thing about Marion Barry. Marion Barry was able to go to the Players Lounge. This is it. Faces.
Right.
He would go to the Pier 7 down at the Pier. He was a mayor that was not afraid to go with the people. I mean,
when you say
Players Lounge, the average person don't know where Players Lounge is. It was in Southeast Washington. It was a hole. in the wall, quiet as kept. It was a little hole in the wall. But people love the Pledge Lounge.
And that's the reason why, you know, I carry in my heart that conversation. Catfish, did I ever thank you? I said, not really, but Marion, guess what, Marion? They could not be a Catfish Mayfield without a Marion Barry. And guess what, Marion? It could not be a Marion Barry without Catfish Mayfield.
No way. That was so awesome that you said that. The number here is 516-418-5482. On our newsmaker line, the one and only Catfish Mayfield. Catfish Mayfield, again, when you got out of entertainment and you what did you decide to do for the rest of your life when the show stopped and you wasn't doing the MCing anymore? What do you think of the comedians today? What do you think of the comedians and entertainment today based on how it was when you were doing it?
Well, I think, though, you know, the outlets are not there anymore. You know, you notice no really live shows come into the city like you went down on F Street and things like that. They're not there because there have been this generational jump. And so it's not there. That's the reason why you don't see no new artists coming up. No one is at Constitution Hall or no one is at the Armory and things like that. So it has been this diametric switch altogether. And so I think that and that is because of the simple fact that when you took out the hiatus of the black that were in the city, that in and of itself began to change the trajectory of what became important and no longer of what was. Because now, if you go places, you only have the marginal black. And it just eats my heart out. I ride the bike every morning. I used to jog every morning at 2 o'clock in the morning. And one white police officer, he was a friend, because otherwise I was going to give it, cut his butt out. He said, you're the first black person. He always had these little quips. You're the first black person I know that be running and the police ain't checking him. And so I went on and took the little hit he took. But I could tear him up at the same time. And so eventually, every morning I would get up and jog, and my knee blew out. So now I ride the bike. Do you know that I leave, oh my God, with disdain and disparity. What I see now, people are laying on the street. Just recently, I called my wife. I live here on the corner of 19th and Independence. And this person was laying under the grate by St. Galata School. And I called my wife on the cell phone, come out here quick. And what I have seen over the period of time, and that's the reason why I call it segregation. If black lives matter, why are black folks with blinders on? What you see on the streets, people are laying. When my wife got out there, I had called the ambulance for this person. And one thing I also know, when I call the ambulance, because they a lot of times will not take them to the hospital. So I know I have to stay out there until they load up that individual. Just recently, I was coming down 8th Street. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. And the reason I do it because not a whole bunch of cars out. And when I get to 8th Street, when I start seeing the worst of our people, laying, when you get to 17th and Benning first, And then I watch how they have commandeered the bus stop. It's smelling like urine. It's just all hooked up. Then when I go further down, I see people just laying on the street. And one morning, I come down. Normally I come down, and when I get to 4th Street, I make a left and come up on Pennsylvania Avenue. But on Saturday, I go across the bridge to North Capitol Street. Oh, my God, when I made the left this time and got up there by the street, Massachusetts, and soon as I turned there, this brother was laying on the side. His leg had just been swollen. And I said, "Brother, are you all right?" No, help me. I called 911. I knew I had to stay out there with that man.
Right now, we got so much people who are hurting during this pandemic. We got people who are hurting, people that don't have a place to stay. We got people that don't have enough food to eat. We got people that don't have money. The new president is vowing to change all that. He's vowing to make sure that we do get people off the street. Everybody's going to get vaccinated. If you're an illegal alien, he's going to make sure you get your green card. He's going to make sure you get your food stamps, a place to stay, your Section 8 house. He's going to make sure that everybody does not be poor or have situations in the United States of America.
Because right now,
black lives do matter, but now we have to make sure it matters even more by doing what you do. If you see something like that, we're supposed to take pride in it and take care of it. We're supposed to call the police. As a former police officer, I took care of homeless people all the time.
All you have to do is to say 911. What is your emergency? There's a person just laying on the street.
On the street, right. You just call 911. Wait till they get there.
911. Everybody has a cell phone.
Everybody's got a cell phone. But I tell you, Catfish, this has been a well of information. I mean, I'm so happy that we have you on our newsmaker line. You have given us the background of what really took place when the city was new, when the city was all black. And you remember segregation. I tell people all the time, there was segregation in Washington, D.C. Blacks couldn't go to Garfinkel's. They couldn't walk in Garfinkel's. There was segregation.
They couldn't work in here.
Hmm?
I said they couldn't work downtown. If you were not highly light-skinned.
I tell you, people don't realize that there was segregation in D.C. D.C. was not always like it is today. There was segregation.
No.
Blacks couldn't walk around D.C. D.C. was considered the South. If you was in D.C., you were considered the South. See, I was born up north. I was born in Philadelphia. But you came to D.C., you were born in the South.
And, I think that if I could get to glean somebody to look at hear my diatribe and what do I want them to get out of this, and that is the fact there should be a level of humanity in every human being, a degree of humanity. Regardless of what color you may be or what branch you're coming from, there should be a sense of humanity. And so, therefore, when we see what we see, how do we make it better? How do we do this or how we do that? That's what I'm hoping that is gleaned from this. Although that I had a structure of parents that worked hard, but we came out of the projects and things like that, a platform was set for us, a platform. Now we're having children, and so therefore they're running amok. So I think that black folks are still in the ones that are still in the city. And then I think that white folks must also come to a reality that this is an integrated process. Now, if I saw a white person, and I did one time, in that I was on jogging, and you know, I saw something, and I to show you what I'm talking about, I saw something that was not right, and the person wanted me to call. I didn't look at a color that the person wasn't black. He was white. I said, and I called him a brother. Brother, do you need some help? Yes, yes. Do you want me to call? Yes, yes. I didn't see color. I saw humanity.
That's what it's all about, man. That's what it's all about.
I told the wife, if I demise before her, please, please let them know that I stayed on the battlefield for the Lord through my death. Now I work with opiate patients and the returning citizen. Why am I doing that? Because I came to the forefront, not because I was a great artist, this here. I came on the bosom on a friend that was killed by a police officer. That's what brought me to prominence. I will never forget that. That's the reason why I have to see the worst of God's children. I must stop for them. I do not want to be called up on the Lord. I teach Sunday school, and that is how I teach, because you might be the only Bible that somebody in the course of a day can read. So I want to make sure that the Lord doesn't call me up. When you saw me in need, and in the Bible say, well, when did I see you, Master? When you saw the worst of my children, you have seen me. That is what's the driving force of me today. I just want to make sure my health is deteriorating.
I appreciate you for even taking the time out and doing this show today. People don't realize how important it is, what you're doing and what you have done. That's why I wanted you to be on for Black History Month. Because it's one of those deals where people don't know what you do until you do it. You know what I mean? So people now know who you are. They know what you do, and now they had opportunity to see what you do. So again, I want to thank you for coming on the show today, and you just keep doing what you're doing. Don't let nobody
do this favor for me, because I would be not doing my due diligence. When Marion, you know, left and, you know, died, and so my gift back to him is that I want to stay on the battlefield. So we started a nonprofit, Destiny Pride.
Internet provider.
And the reason why I call it Destiny Pride, because Marion and I did not, what I feel, it is fulfillment. We now work with the opiate patients, and we because of the fact that we lost our sight, I used to use my basement as a office, but because we deal with some of God's most challenging individuals that are, you know, opiate patients, a returning citizen. And so we finally, I think, found a place because, like I said, our opiate patients, if you're going through something and if you know it's bread in Rufus Mayfield's house, then you might, the situation might overcome you. So now we found a place where we can now take, you know, clients again. Because
I appreciate you tremendously, Catfish. I appreciate what you're doing, and just keep doing what you're doing. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on our Newsmaker line, the one and only Catfish Mayfield, pulling your eyelids open. Stay tuned for the awesome podcast every morning, pulling your eyelids open. Again, let's ring the bell for Catfish Mayfield. Awesome. See you tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock. Wake up,
all right,
everybody.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, man. Appreciate you, man. Awesome hour.